Hey, this is Martin Flash.
And I'm Cammy the Chameleon, and we're the hosts of Arrow Squad.
Join us here each Saturday during Arrow season for all the info and conversation about all of Star City's heroes.
And villains. We'll be covering the hives.
Oh man, did you see Dinah tonight? Once again, the stunt choreography was fantastic.
And the lows.
Now, if I could just be salty Cammy for a second.
We'll be answering all your questions.
And sharing all your thoughts and theories about what's going down with Team Arrow.
So join us here each week.
We are the Arrow Squad.
And welcome to another fine episode of the Star Trek Discovery Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Adam.
And on this episode, which is our seventh episode of the podcast, we are discussing Season 1, Episode 5 of Star Trek Discovery, titled, Choose Your Pain.
Well done.
Yes, thank you. Teleplay by Kemp Powers. And story by the co-showrunners Gretchen J. Berg and Aaron Harberts, along with Kemp Powers. And it was directed by Lee Rose. None of those names, well, I know Kemp is a staff writer on, I don't know the works of Lee Rose. So, all right, as is customary on this show, our first segment is errata.
Incorrect.
All right. So new to the Facebook group is Meyer Brown. And hello, Meyer. And thank you for listening to us. He writes us and points out something we missed on the last podcast. He says, hey, guys, I'm here to register a bit of erratum. In the third episode of your podcast, actually, I guess it was not the last episode. It was a few episodes back, you bemoan the lack of crewmen being demoted in the televised Star Trek universe and how that could lead to interesting character development and fluctuations in the interpersonal dynamics of the ship. You guys seem excited about Burnham's character because she is, in your opinion, the first time we've gotten to see the effects of being demoted on a crew member and on the rest of their compatriots. How did you guys forget about Tom Paris's demotion? Here's a guy who was imprisoned for being a Maquis, earns back the trust of his captain and crewmates through valor, courage, and technical know-how, only to be stripped of rank and humiliated in front of his friends and shipmates on screen. From that point onward in the series, we can see how that demotion affects his character and his relationships with others on the Voyager ship. Love your show and listen every week. Keep up the great work. Live long and prosper. Well,
I have a bit of a defense for this one. At first I thought the Tom Paris statement was going to be based on how his past before the Voyager series even began, which, you know, would be backstory that wouldn't be on screen. But I had actually forgotten about his demotion on screen in season 5, I think it was. Now, honestly, if we're going to bring up Tom Paris, though, I've got to bring up the elephant in the room, which is, why wasn't that character named Nick Locarno from the Next Generation episode to begin with? He was already a disgraced cadet and could have had the same character arc as played by the same actor.
What?
So... yeah. So I think that the inclusion of Tom Paris as a crew member instead of Nick Locarno was the errata to
begin
with.
What is this bizarre segue that's happening right now?
I didn't mean to hit that. I meant to hit this. And my defense is I'm going to sit on my sword and or just plunge the sword into me. I completely forgot about that arc. And have to admit, it's been a number of years since I've gone back and watched Voyager. And I mentioned on the Facebook group, this was when that episode was on. My father was quite ill, and I believe he was in the hospital, came out of the hospital, but then went back in the following month and never came out. So he was his last stint in the hospital. He was in for like 2 years and unfortunately passed away. You know, not to make this a sad story, but Star Trek kind of at the time, it was still very important. I was watching it every week, but I didn't really have a chance very often to watch multiple times. Like I did, you know, in previous years. So I, you know, and like I say, it's been so long since I've watched Voyager. It's probably something you've kind of, made me think about it though. And I'm probably going to go back during the hiatus there, you know, during the holidays and maybe try to do a Voyager rewatch then. Something that, you know, I've wanted to do, but, you've kind of, made me think about it, but yeah. And of course, Ensign Ro Laren, she was another one that, had been in prison, came back to the Enterprise, and, you know, her character was supposed to be the character that ended up being Kira Nerys. And I guess Michelle Forbes, for whatever reason, didn't want to commit to the show. As far as Nick Locarno, I think I'd have to go back and see who wrote that episode, but it could have been something just as trite as they didn't want to pay the writer that came up with the character. Because I don't know if you're aware of this, Adam, but the way that royalties work, whenever you have a character on screen and, you know, that character comes back, you have to pay that writer a royalty for that character.
Was that why you get credits like based on characters created by?
Yes. So in the case of Tom or, you know, Nick Locarno, I'd have to go back and see who wrote that episode. But that, I believe, is why they changed the character. And, you know, it seems crazy, but nevertheless.
Yeah, I always thought it was very confusing to have a character whose backstory was so similar, played by the same actor, but not be the same character.
So, in case what I just said is incorrect.
Incorrect.
Which it could be. I'm not stating that as fact about Nick Locarno. I'd have to go back and confirm or deny that, but I'm just saying that is a possibility as to why that happened. And you know, I do a podcast on The Walking Dead, as you know, and that is also the reason why, like, a character from the TV show, Daryl Dixon, does not show up in the comics, because they would have to pay Frank Darabont for the rights to use the character in the comic book. So it's a very similar thing. What's her name? Clementine in the video game, well-known character in the video game version of The Walking Dead. They don't use her in TV show or the comic for the same reason, because they'd have to pay the video game company.
Interesting stuff. Okay. I love the behind the scenes stuff of how this all works back and forth with storytelling.
Yeah.
It does make a lot of sense, because if the business case isn't there, and you can get around it with a free or cheaper solution, then chances are the production company is going to want to go that route.
Yep. All right. So one news item that I have is that we have the last four titles for this half season were published this past week. So the next episode, which I'm not sure how to say this. I'm not sure if it's Leith or it's Lethe or something other than that. I don't know. You have any idea?
I hope that's a character name. That better be a proper noun of some kind, because I'm not familiar with the word.
It is a Greek, it is the name of the Greek spirit of forgetfulness and oblivion.
Oh, and see, I'd forgotten that.
That's a good one. Yeah, so I'm not sure how you're supposed to say that. See if there's any. It looks like it's a single syllable, according to phonetic on Wikipedia, but I'm not exactly sure how to say it. So anyway, so that's on 1022, episode 6. Episode 7 is a cool title I like. Magic to make the sanest man go mad. I wonder if that has to do with Mud, if that's the return of Harry Mud. I don't know. The following one is a Latin title, and I am probably going to butcher this, but it's Si Vis Pecum Parabellum, or something like that. And then the last episode on November 12th is Into the Forest I Go, episode 9. All right. So, you know what? I did not do the ship announcement bumper. So I'll give that to you. You can slip that in.
Sure.
All right. All right. So now it is time for our thoughts about this episode rating. So, Adam, what did you think of Choose Your Pain?
I absolutely loved this episode. It's amazing that we're this far into the series and they just keep getting better. So I wasn't going to do this, especially not having the entire season to base it off of, but I had to shoot for the stars and just go straight 10 out of 10 overwrought monologues.
Wow.
I loved everything about it. And there was some stilted dialogue that was a little campy, but it worked for exposition and character development. So I didn't even take off points for it.
Well,
Brian, what about you?
I enjoyed it very much too. Not quite as much as you did. But it was still probably the highest mark of the series so far. I would give it a 9.4 unexpected F-bombs.
Yes. I had heard that, you know, profanity, obviously we already had an S-bomb in, I don't want to end up on errata, so I'm going to assume that was episode 3?
Yes, it was.
I didn't realize we were going all the way to F-bomb territory. Bold choice.
Well, you know, CBS All Access has to make sure that you're getting your value.
They want to hook that younger audience, too. They got to appeal to the kids. So,
yeah,
got to make it edgy.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Actually, again, on The Walking Dead, AMC has kind of changed their standards since the last season. And for this season, there are going to be occasional F-bombs. Hold on a second. A very noisy plane. Anyway, so yeah, even on that network, there are going to be occasional F-bombs. And in fact, the finale of Fear the Walking Dead last night, there was an F-bomb. So,
I didn't know that was even allowed on any sort of standard cable package. I thought you had to go to premium for that.
Well, FX has been doing it for at least a year. I know on that O.J. Simpson show, they miniseries, they had it, and there've been, you know, several others where they've had it on FX. So I guess AMC is just following suit. I think it's, you know, it's some of the pressure from HBOs and Showtimes and whatnot of the world.
I'm sorry, hang on, Brian. I'm gonna go outside and just double check to make sure society hasn't collapsed into Armageddon because of the occasional bad word on TV. we'll be back in a couple minutes. And we're back. Society still exists. Kids are still going to school, getting good grades here and there, and helping old ladies across the street. I think we're okay.
I think so too. So anyway, all right. So yeah, good marks. I gave a 9.4. You gave a 10. Some of our listeners, though, weren't quite as up on this. Still gave it some decent marks, but not quite as high. So why don't you give Maury's?
Yeah, Maury gave it 7 classified databases out of 10.
Steve said, I liked it overall. 8 out of 10 rescued captains.
And Mark DeCotes gave it 8 regifted telescopes. So overall, we've got, what would that average out to, a 7.67 average?
I didn't try to calculate it, but all right. Now it is time for
yes.
Our yeses. All right. We got the only listener yeses that I saw come in were from Mark, and we got a voicemail from him yet again. Thank you, Mark. And we will play that all together. So what is your first yes?
It's something I harped on before, so I have to actually walk back my own criticism of Star Trek. We finally have a competent Starfleet command. Lorca goes and pushes for all the use of the spore drive he can possibly get, and they're the ones that tell him to maybe scale it back a little bit because it's not proven. It's one of a kind. Let's not break it before we've even broken it in.
And it's putting a target on the Discovery's back, which we definitely know is the case.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree. And we also, speaking of a competent Starfleet command, I like Admiral Cornwell. Talk about, she's not a badmiral. from what I can see, she seems to be a, like, well, there haven't been many of them. I guess, speaking of Tom Paris, Admiral Paris would be an example, or Admiral Forrest from Enterprise. Some examples of some decent, you know, admirals out there, which for whatever reason seem to be few and far between in the Star Trek, franchise. But, yeah, she seems to be decent. I'm curious. She mentions she is a doctor, when, Lorca says that he doesn't trust doctors. I think I heard that she is a trained psychiatrist, which probably explains even more interest that she has in him. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, I think, as we go on, because I do want to examine one particular thing from this episode, something that he said. All right, what's your next one?
My next one would have to be the Klingon blasters. I thought those were an amazingly well-conceived weapon for the Klingons. It's swift, it's brutal, and it has the bayonet built in, which seems like a very Klingon warrior cast sort of thing to do.
And brutal. Like those, that's not like a phaser that basically evaporates you. Those weapons seem to be painful. You know, it kills you, but it does its sweet time, and it makes it as painful as possible, it seems.
Yeah, your last moments are agony.
Yeah.
And I don't think they come with a stun setting either.
I don't think so either. Well, I guess my next yes.
Yes!
I'm going to give it to, and this is kind of a weird yes, I guess, but the relationship between Burnham and Saru, it's complicated. I mean, he's definitely got some resentment there, and he, you know, talks about it, but I liked the I like the drama between those two and the scenes, you know, where, like, especially at the end when she gives him the telescope, which, you know, I thought about this. You know, maybe the telescope that was on the Shenzhou was a replica, like something that was, you know, I guess they don't call them replicators in the 23rd century, but it could have been a copy of this original one, which would explain a lot. And I wish that they would explain or at least talk to that it's not the exact same telescope. Because if it is the same telescope, you still got to ask, why the heck did they rescue that telescope and not, like, oh, I don't know, the dilithium chamber?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's a good chance of that. But I did like the symbolism, regardless of where the telescope came from. I thought that was a really well thought out scene to transfer that from Burnham to Saru like that.
I thought it was great, too, because in a lot of ways, I think Saru is probably more deserving of it after what Burnham did. That, you know, I mean, I understand, you know, what he's going through a little bit better now. And he's definitely got some deep resentment for her, and for good reason, I think. So anyway, I like those scenes. That's my yes. My next yes.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite aspects of the episode as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, the third and final yes I have to give a shout out to is the classic transporter sounds. That was so much fun to see them operating the controls and hear the classic spooling up of the transporters.
Are you well, I guess we hear the transporters a couple of times, but when they beamed out Lorca and what's his name? Tyler.
Oh, actually, when I first noticed it was when they beamed the tardigrade into the chamber.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. The analog sliders are apparently entirely a thing of the past, since we've now seen touchscreen sliders in next generation DS9 Voyager. I don't know about Enterprise, so I don't want to end up on Errata again, but we've definitely seen it on Discovery. So we've at least got three or four series now that all show touchscreen sliders instead of the analog.
Well, and of course, we see that on, iPads and Galaxy Tabs and
yeah,
you know, it's a thing. So it's one of those 50 years of Star Trek where the technology, like, I'm all past that. I mean, the Klingons are still a bit of a, you know, for me.
What?
Although I'm getting used to them more, I'm kind of treating them more as like a Klingon offshoot, or, you know, like the Romulans. The Romulans aren't the Vulcans, but they're related. They're not the Klingons, the Klingons.
Yeah.
So anyway, my last yes for this episode, I think, and, you know, it's, I think, similar to how I felt about last episode. This felt very Star Trek to me. I mean, obviously updated, but the story of the tardigrade and how it that whole story reminds me of the Horta, and there was an Enterprise story as well, where the Romulans kind of had an Anar or something like that? The other humanoid race of the Andorians, the ones that are white, all white instead of blue.
Mm. So you're more up to speed on Enterprise than I am, since yeah. You did the most recent rewatch of that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, there was a story there, I think, in season 4, where they took over. They had these ships that were, you know, going into Federation territory and were being piloted by, these telepathic, you know, humanoids that, were controlling the devices remotely, you know, sort of like, you know, controlling drones, but, you know, on a much more, like invasive way, similar, I think, in many ways to the tardigrade. So anyway, the story is, reminiscent, I think, of, Star Trek to me. So, it's not yes, the backdrop is war, but it definitely feels Star Trek to me more and more.
Yeah, I think they struck a great balance in this episode of having enough edge to it to still give it a modern feel. But at the heart of it, it was a lot of moral dilemmas being resolved. And that's ultimately what Star Trek is always about. It's presenting an issue and then reasoning between courses of action based on the morality of the characters. I thought it was great that the combinations that they found for this script put interesting pieces against each other to display different ways of handling situations.
Yes. And, you know, and like, again, with Saru, you know, who's took in some ways a very non Star Trek view about it. But at the same time, you know, you look at him trying to save the captain and, you know, he's put in a very difficult position with the tardigrade. And, I really liked that whole story. You know, I liked how the tardigrade, you know, kind of, dried itself. I don't know what the biological, you know, what you call that in biology, but how it kind of went into dormant, until, you know, Burnham and, Tilly freed it. So, yeah. Anyway, okay. Yeah,
crypto hibernation or cryptobiosis or something.
Yeah.
Crypto something,
I
remember.
In fact, that's right. I believe, we got some feedback about that. So,
yeah, it is a real thing. I know that. So they're once again, they're leaning very heavily and trying to stick very true to real science on this organism.
Yeah. Anyway, very good. Do you have any more yeses?
I could just go on talking about the whole episode. Really, like I said, I had such a blast with it. I immediately hit rewind and played it a second time through. Not even just because we have the show to prepare for, but just because it was so entertaining. I wanted to see it again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I watched this, you know, even with also having to cover, Fear last night, I've seen it. I think I've seen it three times, maybe partially part of four times. Yeah. So anyway, really great episode this week. And it's time, unfortunately, for the nose.
No!
All right.
Brian, what you have?
All right. Well, one thing that to me was a bit of a question mark was, and I have to admit, I did not realize that this was Laurel. Okay. How I realized that it was Laurel, and just so you know what I mean, and, you know, listeners, so you know what I mean, the female captain is the same female Klingon that we just saw last week on the, you know, the T'Kuvma's ship. This is the same Klingon woman. And I didn't realize it. I looked at her and I thought, okay, looks very similar, but I don't know that but sure enough, it was her. Okay. And how do I know this? Well, After Trek, dead giveaway, but the credits had Mary Chifo listed in the credits at the end of the episode. So then I was like, huh, they had her playing another female Klingon. That's kind of weird. But then on After Trek, it was pretty much stated that is Laurel. So I thought it was a bit of a weak point that Laurel is the captain, and yet she's had Tyler for 7 months, which I want to talk about more in detail because I have some suspicions about that, that I will talk about later, I think, in the general discussion. But if that's true, she'd only basically been the captain of this ship for what, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe?
Something like that.
Yeah. So, okay. Did she have Tyler on the Klingon T'Kuvma ship or what? Like, I very unclear as to what's going on, or is the whole thing a ruse, which I want to talk about more.
Yeah, it could be. They've got two problems going on here. One would be the story explanation, and the other one would be the general problem of the Klingons, which is they don't look distinct enough amongst themselves for the audience to be able to easily identify one from another.
And, you know, with the way that the way that they've, you know, outfitted the Klingons, or, you know, the makeup of the Klingons, it's not. Now, I liked how she spoke English, okay? But the thing is, though, like, compare this to Klingons of the past. It's difficult, I think, for those actors to, you know, talk in ways that make it, what's the word I'm looking for? Just have their distinctive kind of tone on it. Instead, it just sounds like they've got crackers in their mouth and, you know, they're mumbling. Mm-hmm. Now, I think Mary Chifo, who plays, you know, this Klingon, I think she's one of the best ones of the Klingons that we've seen, in speaking Klingon. But still.
Yeah, I think what they've done here is, by giving the Klingons more makeup to make them look more alien, they've made them look less human, but they've also made them look more generic. It was easier when more of the actor's face was showing through the makeup in other series to differentiate one Klingon from another.
And again, it's worth saying that this was not the direction of the current showrunners. It was the direction of Brian Fuller, you know, and we've talked about it several times at this point. I still got to ask, why Brian Fuller? Why did you make these choices? I don't get it.
Yeah. I think at this point, we're just going to have to shrug our shoulders and accept that rather than try to look for an explanation, because we're not going to get one.
Yeah. And that's all we can do. We can still point out shortcomings, but we have to accept the Klingon ancestor as they are now, and you know, because that's the way they are. Simple as that. All right, what's your first no?
No!
Thank you. My first no also involves the Klingons. Now, immediately, this isn't Georgiou and Burnham beating the Klingons in hand-to-hand combat, but it is still two beaten-up prisoners of war who, at this point, we're assuming are a little malnourished, too, because they've been refusing food. Besting two Klingon warriors with weapons in battle. This needs to stop. I'm having a hard time believing that the Klingons are this warrior race with superior physical skill and aggression, and yet every time they come up against a Federation officer somehow manages to beat them, and in this case, break their necks in combat.
Yeah, and in short order, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for that matter, you know, Lorca and Tyler, you know, they may not have killed, you know, the rest of the ones that they killed in hand to hand, but they killed a lot of Klingons on that ship.
Yeah, apparently the only two Klingons that were carrying guns, or I'm sorry, there were three total because someone did fire off a shot and miss, of course. Nobody else apparently had guns because they just started charging at the armed Federation officers and, of course, getting disintegrated for it.
Yeah.
Brian, how about you? What's your next one?
I don't really have another no that I can think of. I may come up with one. You know, there are questions that I'm going to bring up, but there are no no's. But I will say that there's probably going to be a definite no next week.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there was something in the preview of next week that was on After Trek that I did not like at all. And I don't think I should even mention it because it is preview. And I'll just make you wonder what it is until next week.
See, and I'm waiting as well because I did not have time to watch After Trek this week. So the preview that they showed after the credits of this episode got cut off on the PS4 CBS All Access app.
Oh, really?
So I might not have or might have seen what you're talking about. We'll just have to wait and see, I suppose. I did have one more no, though.
Oh, thank you. You just reminded me of another no. So go ahead.
All right. Why, when Saru was putting together his little program to monitor his traits versus the former captains that were the most decorated in Starfleet, why did the computer ask for a reason to run the program? Since when do you have to justify a command to a computer?
That is a good question, Adam. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right.
Yeah. What is the purpose for this program? You don't need to know, computer. Just do what I tell you.
Yeah, that is a good point. The computer did ask for the purpose, and I don't know if they were, you know, trying to make it seem that it was trying to deliver. It wanted to know what results, you know, to deliver. I don't know, but yeah. All right, so you reminded me of another no, so I'll just get it out of the way. CBS All Access. Okay. And specifically, I want to give a real big groan for the blatant product placement that we saw in this episode. And it had to do when Tilly, Burnham, and Stamets were going through the tardigrade and trying to solve the problem. And Burnham said this.
When Ripper borrows DNA from the mycelium, he's granted an all-access travel pass.
Who wrote that? Les Moonves? If you don't know who that is, that's the CEO of CBS.
Who is quite proud at being able to run this show for a profit despite its enormous budget.
Yeah. So that is definitely deserved of a no. And I will also tie in yet again the CBS All Access app. And I will say, you know, I've talked about its lack of rewind, but its other thing that drives me crazy is you can't seem to stop it from replaying. Like, it will just keep replaying and replaying. And like last night, I had it playing, and it's not just, okay, it's not just the app, it's the CBS.com website as well. So I had the episode playing in the browser last night, and I fell asleep, okay? I think I had finished watching it for a third time, and it was during when After Trek came on right after it. Well, I woke up and the darn thing's still playing, and it just kept on playing. It would play the, Choose Your Pain, and then it would play the After Trek, and then it would play Choose Your Pain again, and then After Trek again, over and over and over again.
You know, I'm glad to know I'm not the only one that falls asleep at my computer watching stuff.
No, I do it all the time. But it's almost like they're doing it so that they can boast how many times people have watched the episodes.
Each playthrough counts as a download. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's a minor no, but still, it's annoying. They really, hopefully with the additional, you know, money that they're getting from, you know, new subscribers and that, they're going to spend a little money on the apps, on the app and the website and, you know, give it things like, oh, I don't know, a rewind. Oh, I don't know, the ability to, not continuous play. It's just, it's very, very annoying.
Yeah, they're trying to use the streaming service to shed the perception of the network as being old people only, because they do have one of the oldest viewership bases of the networks.
Yes.
They need to pay more attention to making sure that their app experience is as user-friendly and cutting-edge as possible to show that they know how to present a product to a younger audience, because that's what the younger audience expects, is something as good as Netflix.
And it's also worth saying, the Star Trek audience is, you know, you can't say this, you know, for everybody, you know, that watches Star Trek, but they tend to be, you know, above average intelligence, you know, above average in education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a great demographic. And, you know, as such, we are usually technically sophisticated, and we expect, you know, like if we have CBS All Access, chances are we have other streaming services like Netflix, like Hulu, like HBO Now or HBO Go or whatever, Amazon Prime. And, you know, those sites or those apps have a certain standard that I don't think are being hit yet with CBS All Access. So, you know, hopefully they'll get better over time. Anyway, let's move on, shall we?
Certainly.
Open hailing frequencies for the rest of our feedback. All right. And for our fifth episode in a row, we've got a wonderful voicemail from Mark. So here we go.
Hey, Brian. Hey, Adam. Mark from Ontario, Canada here with my feedback for episode 5, Choose Your Pain. I give this episode 8 out of 10 re-gifted telescopes. Now, first off, I have to say I'm really liking Lieutenant Stamos's character. He's still obnoxious and conceited, but you can tell that he does have a heart. And I really hope he's a longtime character. We know there's something strange that happened at the end of the episode there, but just overall, the more I learn about him, the more I like him. And I had mentioned last week how I'd like the Doctor. Well, I think it's really cool that the two of them are actually a couple. Now, I would love to know if there is some sort of database or website somewhere that's keeping track of all these different Starfleet badges. We noticed on Discovery the way some people have one badge, and then I know Cadet Tilly has a different badge on her uniform, and then the Admiral, whenever Lorca was talking to the Admiral, she had a different one. I would love to know if there's somewhere out there that's keeping track of all these badges and the meaning, what they represent. Now, for the first time that I can remember in Star Trek, we got some vulgarity in this one, with Cadet Tilly saying, "This is so bleeping cool." Now, was that CBS's way of telling us, hey, this is why we can't show it on regular TV and you have to pay for CBS All Access for it? Although I must say, I'm not used to any sort of swearing on TV shows aired on space here in Canada. My opinion, it wasn't really necessary, but it didn't really bother me that much. Now, I did appreciate this episode more than previous episodes because it didn't have the Klingon story. Yes, we had Klingons in it. They were a threat, but we didn't have that story of what's happening with the Klingons that really I've had no interest in. Now, speaking of the Klingons, we did see their ship. We got Harry Mudd this episode, which we knew was coming. It was anticipated. And I must say, I was a little underwhelmed with the use of the character. Now, I am hoping that this was just laying the groundwork for more to come. He did tell Lorca that he was going to be coming after him, so I'm hoping that we do see more of Mudd in the future. And speaking of Lorca, I really want to know more about how Lorca escaped from his ship, but ended up blowing up his crew. I want details on this. Now, I really don't know what to make of Saru, whether he's Commander Saru or Acting Captain Saru. I liked him in the first episode, but since then, he's kind of grating on me a little bit. Now, I know he's going to be a character. Doug Jones is such a great actor. I know he's going to be a character that I'll probably end up liking in the long run. But so far, there's been very little to make him endearing to me. And with that said, that's one of the differences between Discovery and all the other Star Trek shows. Most of the other Star Trek shows, the crews all seem to get along, if not be best friends. I mean, the worst case was probably Voyager, where you had the Maquis and Starfleet trying to work together with some tension, but they still ended up getting along, even though they might have a spat here and there. Where on Discovery, it seems that sometimes there's actually hostilities between the crew, which is very different for a Star Trek series. Now, I'll give you my turbo lift up and turbo lift down moments. My turbo lift up moments, Lieutenant Tyler, who we were introduced this episode. I don't know if he's going to be a recurring character. The actor looked familiar, and it seems to me he might have actually been at some of the Comic-Con things. If that's the case, I liked him, even though we didn't get very much of him. I'm wondering if he's going to be the replacement for Commander Landry, if we're going to find out that on his former ship, he was head of security or something like that. Now, my other turbo lift up moment was those Klingon disruptors. That was cool. I've always liked the Klingon disruptors. Unlike the phaser, there's no mercy with those guns. The only thing I might say about them is the traditional disruptor. I remember it just seemed to be so painful. When you shot somebody with one of those, they would scream in agony until they dissolved. Where this one here was just, oh, they got hit and they vaporized. Not that I'm a masochist or all, but I would have just liked to see a little bit more screaming and pain for those who got hit. Now, my turbo lift down moments. Why didn't Lorca and the pilot on that shuttle stand back from the door? They got these rifles, these blasters, they're holding them in their hand, and they go right up to the door and wait for the door to open. Why don't you just take a few steps back so you have a good line of fire? And then they wouldn't have been hit as soon as the door opened. And speaking of firing, why didn't Lorca finish off that Klingon captain? It's not like he thought it was just another officer. He knew darn well that was the captain of this ship, and he saw her on the floor, writhing in pain. You're in the middle of a war. Finish off your enemy. We know darn well with the scars that she's got that she will be back and she'll be a thorn in his side. It's just a matter of time. Well, that's it for my feedback. Brian, you did ask me last week to share the differences between Star Trek Discovery and The Expanse. I won't go into a lot of detail here other than to say that Star Trek is sci-fi fantasy, where The Expanse I would classify as sci-fi reality. If you look in our current day, a few hundred years in the future, I don't think anybody anticipates that our world will be like Star Trek. But when you look at The Expanse, I can honestly say 300 years in the future, we will probably look very much like the sci-fi in The Expanse does. So it's very much based on reality, and physicists and all that are behind it to prove that the science in The Expanse is true and that the way the future will turn out will probably be very much like it. So that's the one thing I'm going to give on this feedback, other than to say that The Expanse is a really great show and you really should check it out. And if you decide to, have a look at Tales from the Rosinante, The Expanse podcast at solotalkmedia.com. That's my show. Anyways, keep up the great work, guys. This is Mark from Ontario, Canada, out.
Well, thanks, Mark. And I can second that about the Tales from the Rosinante. As you can tell from his wonderful feedback, he does a wonderful podcast on The Expanse. Check it out at solotalkmedia.com. And if you're into Orphan Black, he also does the Orphan Black podcast, which, again, wonderful podcast for a wonderful show that just ended recently. Okay. So he mentioned Stamets. I'm going to table talking about him because we get a little bit more about Stamets in the next couple pieces of feedback. But the badges, I have to think that someone, somewhere, official or not, is keeping track of that, and we'll probably see that in some new technical manual or something soon. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I've seen these more fleshed out and defined in that sort of, you know, book or expanded media of some sort over the years. And I think it's just they're using that now to put it in the series itself to make it truly official. The thing that I really love about this, though, is that I hadn't even, like, I paid attention. I saw a few of the badges that they were using. I didn't actually fixate on them enough to realize that there were so many different ones. And it's just great that no matter how much attention you pay to an episode, it's never a guarantee what somebody else is going to fixate on. So the fact that Mark picked up on this and it just kind of got glossed over in my viewings, it's so refreshing to have this podcast and have the feedback from all the listeners pointing out things that we don't even consider.
Well, the thing that I'm interested in, I want to see are the an explanation for those black badges, because I still think it's Section 31, but we haven't really seen them again since Episode 3. So I'm very curious about that. What is the V? What did I write? Do you remember what V was?
Oh, I wish I did. Actually, I saw as you were writing this little peek behind the curtain. We keep a Google document open for our show notes to keep us on track throughout the podcast. And especially as we're playing things back, like Mark's voicemails, for example, we leave notes for ourselves, especially because he brings up so much good feedback. We have to leave notes for ourselves while we're playing it back to know what to reference. And we noted V as a quick shorthand during the voicemail. And I'm not actually sure at this point what that referred to.
I don't know either. But I do want to mention this actually plays into it. So he mentioned about Tyler. Okay. So Tyler, he's wondering if she's going, or if he is going to replace Commander Landry. And I'm pretty sure the answer to that is going to be yes. But as I hinted at before, I'm really curious about that whole 7 months thing. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, when we see Tyler, he doesn't look all that banged up. And for that matter, he didn't have a very, you know, for being a POW for 7 months, he didn't have a very long beard. Now, mind you, perhaps Durrell was you know, making sure that he was, groomed. But here's the conspiracy. Okay, so we know Vok was what she said, you know, last episode, that he would lose everything and that, you know, he was going to go back to the House Mokai, which I assume the fact that we see her commanding a ship, this is probably a ship of House Mokai. I don't know. But could Tyler actually be Vok? What do you think about that?
That would be truly interesting. It wouldn't be unprecedented. We saw it in the original series in The Trouble with Tribbles. So Klingons can undergo surgery to look like humans.
We've certainly seen like the changelings on Deep Space Nine impersonate. As well. Yeah.
And I was wondering that as well. The only thing I would say against that is he seems to really be trying to physically beat her to death in that hallway. He did not seem to be pulling his punches or putting on any kind of a show whatsoever.
Or was it Klingon foreplay?
very true.
Well, anyway,
she did recover pretty quickly.
I don't know if this is, you know, that he is a spy, okay, or that he is Vok. But it would be really interesting if he was. So I'm not going to predict that he is Vok or that he is some other spy. But doggone it, wouldn't it be interesting if he is? And, you know, I'm guessing that there was another Lieutenant Tyler, you know, so he's impersonating Lieutenant Tyler, if that's the case. But doggone it, that would be an awesome story twist if that's that ends up being the case. And, you know, I'm saying this in Episode 5, and if it turns out that we find this out in, like, you know, Episode 9 or, you know, into the second half, you know, okay, so I figured this out. But it's still going to be really interesting getting to that point.
Right.
So,
yeah, I think with Tyler, though, I'm on board with the prediction, at least, that he's going to replace Landry, because Lorca did say after he thanked Lorca for rescuing him, he said, what, bringing you back onto a ship in the middle of a war? So with a target on its back. So he implied that Tyler's not going anywhere now that he's on Discovery.
And he said there's nowhere else he'd rather be. So, you know, anyway, I really like Tyler, and I'm really hoping he's not Vok, but even if he was Vok, I liked the character, so.
Were you surprised that he survived the episode? I thought he was going to be the red shirt.
Well, no, only because I knew who that was. So I knew that there was still a regular that, his name's been in the credits, you know, all five episodes, and we hadn't seen, Shazad Latif, I think is his real name. I knew that he wasn't going to be like one episode and out, but that other guy, I mean, man, that's another thing too. This is pretty darn violent, this episode. I mean, we saw some brutal stuff, like the Klingons, like, you know, smashing in that guy's head and you know, the neck snapping, and, you know, for Star Trek, you know, of old, this is definitely an updated Star Trek, and I like that. Don't get me wrong, but
yeah, just that concept that their way of torturing their prisoners is to make their prisoners decide which prisoner gets tortured.
Yeah, I agree with what Mark said about, you know, I wrote in the notes there, Klingon light, because it was Klingons within the context of the, you know, Lorca story, and I like that better than what we had seen before, because the Klingon segments had kind of dragged a little bit, and, you know, maybe it's because, you know, so much was in subtitles, or just, you know, the story itself isn't all that compelling because we don't know the backstory, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but yeah, in this story, I thought that it was interesting. Although, like I say, I really want to know the story behind Laurel, and, you know, certainly moving up very quickly. She's on that, you know, the flagship or whatever for 6 months, stranded, and now she's already a captain. So.
And I'm kind of surprised, honestly, that women are being represented as equals in Klingon culture. I thought that the stereotype that they're trying to portray, that they might be a little bit more backwards thinking, and they would use that as another juxtaposition between the sensibilities of the forward thinking enlightened Federation and this primitive warlike species that, you know, is very male chauvinistic.
I think that some of the houses are more more equal or more matriarchal than others. And, you know, so that's another reason why that ship was probably House Mokai, simply because, you know, she's the captain. But I also got the impression that, you know, that wasn't necessarily the case for all, you know, of the major houses. But we'll see. I mean, we see, you know, again, we can't really judge it by the past Klingons, because so much has changed. But, like, we see Martok's wife, for example, who seems to be more of a, on Deep Space Nine, like more of a governing the house, you know, compared to being a warrior or whatever. You know, that kind of typical, I don't know, like old style royalty, or, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Not royalty, but, you know, lords and ladies of the, you know.
More of a feudalistic system.
Exactly. Feudalistic. Thank you. Yeah. I like the disruptors. So, you know, and I talked about that before. You did too. So I didn't really agree with you, Mark, but, I thought it was brutal enough, actually. So,
yeah, I think Star Trek III was probably the pinnacle, or Star Trek II even was the pinnacle of disturbing disruptors.
Yeah.
No one got off easy with those weapons.
Yeah, exactly. Waiting for the door. I can't disagree with that. That scene seemed to be, I didn't give it a no, but I thought that was a little bit weak myself. It just, I didn't really understand why, they didn't shoot. You know, they seem to be like, there seemed to be an opportunity there to shoot at the Klingons, and they didn't do it. Instead, they,
yeah, both ideas were good, but not in tandem. If you're going to hide and ambush, then you need a melee weapon. If you're going to grab a gun, stand back and use it at range.
And the finisher, I would have to agree. I think obviously some plot armor was involved there. And the fact that, you know, she's probably going to be disfigured, scarred. So when we see her next, and I'm sure we will recognize her. You know, so I think that was why, but yeah, they definitely could have finished her off, but they didn't. And the last thing I had asked Mark, you know, about comparing his you know, the podcast that he does, of course, on The Expanse versus Star Trek Discovery, and that was exactly what I was looking for. You know, the Star Trek is like, you know, sci-fi fantasy versus the gritty realism of The Expanse. Have you ever watched The Expanse?
I have not had a chance to catch up on that one yet.
Really good show. I have to admit, Mark, I am a few episodes behind. I didn't finish the second season all the way through, but I will before it comes back. I'll probably, if I have access to those episodes, I'll probably watch them over the Christmas break or Thanksgiving or something. Anyway, really good show. And, in a lot of ways, similar, I think, to, you know, like, science fiction for 2017, I would say, which I would agree, Discovery is as well. So, all right. Do you want to take, Maury's feedback and, how I kind of categorize this as I, just listeners, so you know, he mentioned a first part of his feedback got into some stuff that other people, talked about. So, and we had some comments about, so I thought we would stop with that and then we'll continue what he had to say, once we get back, away from that. So anyway, go ahead with Maury's feedback.
Sure. Maury chimed in with a little bit of trivia for us first. Said, Lorkin was the captain of the USS Baran. Baran was the name of the failed Soviet shuttle. Very last scene of this episode was creepy. Was Stamets' reflection held in the mirror after he left the room?
Very fitting to play that. So, all right, yeah. So what was the reflection? What do you think was going on there?
I don't even know specifically what to theorize yet. It was interesting because the music was really what painted the scene. It wasn't the long-held gaze. I was thinking about this. If you were to change the music bed underneath it, the information portrayed to the audience would be completely different. The inference with the ominous discordant note is that there's something sinister going on. If they had just played a nice pleasant music bed under that, you could just infer that he's holding the long gaze in the mirror because he had some sort of transformative experience and he's just contemplating things. But to smile with that ominous note held out, it definitely implies that there's something dangerous going on with the experience he just had. What that may be, I'm not really sure. I don't even know if it's sinister on his part or if there's something else at play beyond his control. What do you think, Brian?
Well, before I say anything, just give what Steve said. He said, I agree with the question posed by Maury. Did the reflection actually remain, or was it just for the audience to see the possible inner conflict? Well, I think it definitely did remain. And it's a question of what it was. And, you know, is he somehow displaced because of the experience. You know, obviously he's been affected by the tardigrade DNA. And what does this mean? I mean, how is he affected? We've heard some rumors about there being a possibility of a Mirror Universe episode. Could this have been the Mirror Universe's Stamets that we see at the end? You know, is that what this is? Is this like an entryway into the Mirror Universe? Or is it just side effects of, you know, being able to travel, you know, everywhere all at once?
Yeah, they clearly didn't understand what the side effects may be from plugging a human being into it. So they may learn through unfortunate trials.
Yeah, and it was one of those things. It was subtle, too, the effect. But, you know, especially if you kind of lingered on it, you had to say, you know, what just happened there? Because, you know, we see him walk away, and then we see him not walk away. So, and it seemed like it repeated. It didn't seem like anything different had happened in that second, you know, reflection or whatever. So I think it's too early to say what it is. It would be cool if it does somehow tie into the Mirror Universe. Cause, you know, we don't really know too much about how the universes are tied together. I know there was a lot about it in Enterprise in that episode that they did. But we don't know. We don't know. And I am curious. So there are no answers. There's only speculation. And I think whatever you take from it, this pretty much shows to me like, okay, they're not torturing the tardigrade anymore. But clearly there are side effects of this kind of travel. And like we say, we are probably not going to see it in the 24th century because it's just too dangerous.
Yeah, it seems they've done, with the exception of the Klingons, unfortunately, the show writers have done a good job of trying to address all the obvious continuity questions that we have.
Yeah.
The spore drive being the biggest one, of course. So they're already laying the groundwork to explain why this seemingly way better mode of transportation is abandoned even 10 years into the future.
And it's worth saying, too, that you know, I guess we're beating a dead horse, but it's like the Klingons, like I can accept everything in this show, but the Klingons are the one thing that kind of, you know, kind of still bother me. And, I really don't have an explanation as to why, but it's everything else in many ways can either be explained or you have to say, hey, come on, it was 50 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
So
can I propose a theory?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to hear what theory, what you got.
Well, a theory for your dissatisfaction.
All right.
There's no need to have changed their appearance. You can update ships and other details because you can do so much better now. But there was nothing wrong with the way the Klingons looked that they needed such an overhaul.
I couldn't agree with you more, Adam. That's in fact, I think I said some variation of that in a past episode. There wasn't any reason to change them. So why did they change them? It just seemed to be they changed them to change them.
Yeah. And that's the worst reason.
Yeah. And, you know, you can change the costuming and you can change, you know, the technology and, you know, how the ships look and all that stuff. And I can accept that, but there's nothing. Okay. Let's face it. The Klingons from the 60s, you know, they weren't very good the way that they are. So or they were back then. So, you know, I think everyone accepted a different kind of Klingon, but there was nothing wrong with the 90s Klingons. You know, those are the ones that have gained acceptance. I feel like we're beating a dead horse.
What is this bizarre segue that's happening right now? Can we maybe stay on point?
We are. It's the Klingons. All right. All right. Let's move on to the rest of Maury's feedback. Do you want to take it or should I?
Why don't you take this one, Brian?
All right. Well, shout out to the 2009 Star Trek movie in this episode. Lorca meets with the Admiral who tells her that... Lorca meets with the Admiral and tells her that the schematics for the spore drive were sent to Starfleet. The Admiral replies that they were sent to a new classified facility in Jefferson, Iowa. Iowa was the location of a starship being assembled in the 2009 flick. Cryptobiosis seemed like a self-defense mode of the tardigrade. Roll up in a ball, choosing no more pain. Burnham chose no more pain by releasing the tardigrade. Saru chose no more pain by rejecting the computer's assessment of his actions as captain and continued healing with his acceptance of Burnham on the Discovery. That's a good point, Mari. The no more pain. Yeah, actually, I guess choose your pain. That also fits the what happened on the Discovery this episode. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a good point, Mari.
Yeah, there were a lot of different situations presented to the characters where they had to decide how they were going to either defend themselves or react to the stimuli. And, the tardigrade chose to act on instinct. I think Lorca did to an extent as well. He seems programmed to be a warrior. Saru actually chose to reject his instinct. So rather than protect himself, he grew beyond his instincts. And Burnham did a little bit of both, I think. It was pointed out that she did took the same sort of actions that led to her mutiny by basically being told one thing and doing another because she didn't get the answer she wanted from the captain, Saru in this case.
Yeah, he was very, very correct about that point too.
Yeah, I love the way he pointed that out because until he pointed it out in the episode, I hadn't been thinking about it as an audience member, but he was absolutely right. Every time she doesn't get her way, she simply defies orders, which is a major fault of any sort of chain of command in Starfleet. So for her to be this prized first officer, but then have such disregard for the chain of command and disobey orders is a pretty big character fault.
Yes, I agree. It is. And I am curious to see, if she's going to redeem herself fully, she needs to redeem herself with that character trait, I think.
Yeah, sometimes she just has to abide by whatever's ordered of her.
Yeah. And the way the tardigrade rolled up, it reminded me of those, what do you call those little, is it doodle bugs or potato bugs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But again, very true to form. I remember seeing photographs of that at that museum exhibit just a little while ago. Someone's paying great attention to the real world science going on here.
All right. Want to give Steve's?
Yeah. Steve Brown chimed in. He said, the last scene was creepy. I don't understand why Burnham released Ripper. They were going to try and communicate with it, and now it's gone. Loved seeing Rainn Wilson. Again, we see single Starfleet members easily defeating Klingons in hand-to-hand combat. Has it always been this easy for them? Thank you, Steve, for getting my back.
Yep.
Creepy last scene. The releasing of Ripper, I thought, was also a little sudden. I didn't think they had to jettison Ripper right away. They could have tried to revive it, resuscitate it. I'm not really sure what the term is when you're in cryptobiosis.
Heal it.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let it recover a little bit before you dump it out in space and hope it can go make its own way.
Yeah, and I just imagine that Lorca is going to be furious when he finds out.
That's a really good question, is how he's going to react to that. It was, at least in this case, it was done on Saru's orders, so I think the brunt of the fallout will go on his shoulders and not Burnham's.
Well, he didn't say release the tardigrade. He said, you know,
save its life.
Save its life. Yeah. You know, so I think they could have saved its life without, releasing it. I mean, they could have just put it in the, you know, the spore garden or something, you know, but I don't know. I suppose certainly setting it free would have that effect, but you know, it like, do they have enough of the DNA? Can they synthesize that? You know, how's that going to go forward?
Well, apparently they've proven that you can just plug a human into it and get the same results. So, with obvious side effects that they are so far seemingly unaware of. So
yeah,
the whole mirror universe thing might come in because they might use a different member each time and have some sort of a protocol to, you know, heal that crew member back up.
Who knows? Maybe the whole tardigrade, you know, the spore, what they call it, the mycelium network. Maybe that has, maybe that explains how the mirror universe exists, or maybe that network, exists between the two universes or something.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised, by the way, that it turned out to be Stamets and not Burnham in the drive?
Yeah, I kind of was surprised, actually. But Burnham was under, you know, confined to quarters, so it does make sense that it wasn't her. But, you know, I would understand Stamets. I mean, you know, he's very committed to his work, so and he didn't want to, you know, keep harming the tardigrade. So, you know, it made sense for him to do it. But yeah, I would have kind of expected her to do it.
Yeah, as soon as she was the one with the revelation to discover that Homo sapien was compatible enough to operate it, I thought for sure she'd be the one in that machine. Also because she was told to stay out of it and go to her quarters.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to Todd's feedback. Todd says, I had to watch this one 3 times. I kept falling asleep and missing things. I have no idea why Lorca was in the shuttle in the first place. I know, to get captured by Klingons for the plot reasons. But really, why? Saru seemed weak in this one. Hypercritical, confidence issues. Burnham is not his therapist, so why is he opening up to her? The F-bombs didn't impress me. It was out of character and forced. Secret base in Jefferson, Iowa. Do we know what that is? I liked that they got rid of the tardigrade. I think Stamets at the end was replaced by his mirror version, maybe after being connected to the multiverse from connected to the spore drive. I'm looking forward to mirror episodes, which hopefully will be next week. Oh, so we know where Todd is going with this. He thinks that, that it definitely was mirror universe. So, you know, it's too early to know, I think, but it very well could be.
Yeah. Just because even if this does play out to be the truth and we have the mirror universe Stamets on board now, this series is so good at taking its time in revealing things. I'm not sure that just because it's mirror universe Stamets that next week is going to be the mirror universe episode. He might lurk for a little while.
Yeah.
Give it an episode or two and find his footing before he does whatever mirror universe Stamets has in mind.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to know if that is him and, you know, how does he differ from the other, Stamets? Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You want to take, Stefan's feedback?
Yes. He said, it feels like the whole episode was aimed to introduce Lorca with Harry Mudd and establish their rivalry. How do they get Lorca and Mudd to meet? Kidnap him, get him in prison, and then rescue him all in one episode. Put Discovery in an impossible position to jump in, rescue Lorca, and leave while the tardigrade is doubtful to survive the second jump. Stamets finds a solution that includes him becoming something else with the tardigrade's DNA in his veins. Aside from everything else, we get introduced to one main cast member in Ash Tyler that's picked up with Lorca while escaping the Klingons. This was a quick episode, in my opinion, an urge to go forward, set up the rescue, and execute it. Saru step away from a moral standpoint where he's being fully aware and put the tardigrade's life in danger. In being a prey species, he ends up with the need to choose to sacrifice life.
Interesting.
Yeah, that last point was something I hadn't actually considered before, is how Saru had to struggle with that decision, knowing what it's like to be the one being sacrificed for someone or something else, and to have to make that decision that the tardigrade's life was less valuable than Lorca's in this case, had to give him some sort of personal conflict.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, in many ways, you have to, like, you know, especially when he was, like, demanding that he be revived, that was, you know, kind of a surprising stance for Saru to make. You know, so, yeah, I agree with you, Stefan. That's interesting to, you know, put Saru in that point. And, you know, that was I liked him being in that position. He seemed, you know, very unsure of himself. That whole thing where he was going to, you know, grade himself against, the five captains, which, by the way, did you notice the five captains that they had?
I did. I did not recognize the name of the first one.
Robert April?
Yes.
That is a deep cut. He is the first captain of the Enterprise. So,
oh, prior to Archer?
No. The 1701 Enterprise. So originally it was captained by Robert April, and then Christopher Pike, and then James T. Kirk.
So does that go back to the original series lore then?
I believe it was mentioned in the animated series, but originally when, Roddenberry pitched the series, the captain at the time was, Robert April. And, you know, I don't know when it got changed to Christopher Pike, but, you know, before the cage was made, the character's name was changed, but they still referred to Robert April in a few different things, but I believe it was mentioned in the animated series, or so I have heard.
No, what a great little Easter egg. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Saru in general, I thought was really well done in this episode. The acting by Doug Jones was fantastic. And I like that the situation almost wrote itself into a very predictable story arc of him overcompensating for his prey drive and trying too hard to seem confident and almost becoming a bully as a result. I thought that's where they were going with it. I thought with him being overly demonstrative and, you know, assertive, which didn't seem very Saru-like, I thought that they were going to go the route of him overcompensating and having to have someone like Burnham walk him back at a critical moment and tell him that he'd gone too far. And only then does he relent when someone else tells him that he's doing too much. So for him to be able to check himself and keep himself in balance, I thought was a nice change of pace over the usual story devices that they usually rely on.
All right. Well, that's it for our feedback. So is there anything else that you want to cover that we haven't talked about? I have one thing, and I think I think it's the same thing that you have, that I see. So why don't you say it?
Would it be about, Lorca?
Yes.
Well, go ahead, Brian. I just gave my take on Saru. What do you think about Lorca?
I thought I really got to understand Lorca better in this episode. I thought he was awesome. Now the one, so the character of Lorca, I loved. I loved him in this episode. You know, he did seem very heroic, somewhat flawed, but, you know, courageous and well played, of course, by, Jason Isaacs, as I knew he would be. I mean, when I heard that he was cast in this role, I was so happy to hear that, because I pretty much loved him and everything he's been in. Now, okay, so he sacrificed his entire crew So what do you make of that?
It's one of those moments that defines this series and makes it stand out from the rest of Star Trek. Because I can't imagine any other captain that we know of making that decision. But if he was absolutely certain that there was no escape for them, there was only a life of torture and humiliation, it seems like something he would do. Whenever he makes up his mind about something, we have not seen him backtrack on anything yet.
Yeah.
No matter what evidence he's shown, he's always standing by his conviction. So the moment he decided there was no future for that crew, I could see him executing them as an act of mercy.
And I have to wonder, you know, you remember earlier in the episode when Cornwell was talking to him about Burnham, she said something like, you know, is this like another thing that will make people judge you? That's paraphrased. That's not exactly how she said it. But makes me wonder how he sacrificed the crew. I would have to think that's kind of what she was hinting at, that people have judged him for doing that, because that is an extreme measure and not typically something. I mean, if anything, right, you would expect him to be the last man on the ship, you know, go down with the ship as the captain, not, you know, the guy that gets away, and certainly not the guy that kills the crew, you know. So I have to think that that's what Cornwell meant, is that act, and, you know, bringing on Burnham, although at this point, you know, Burnham is the reason why they got the spore drive going. It's the reason why they got the tardigrade in the first place, I would say. You know, so, I mean, she's proven her worth. And obviously, you know, that hasn't like translated itself off the ship, but that's what I have to think, Cornwall. That's what she meant, though, that, being judged for what he did.
That was my thought as well. Yeah. My question for the episode was, how does Harry Mudd know about that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I have to think that he knows about it from Rel, you know, that she was feeding him intel, I guess. She probably knows because of the, you know, House Mokai and how they are, you know, spies and all that stuff. So I have to think that that's where he knew. But yeah, that made you wonder.
Yeah, I wonder if he was feeding information about other prisoners to her just to save his own skin, or if he's an actual plant who's collaborating or conspiring with the Klingons for some reason.
Yeah. What else you got?
Well, actually, at this point, since we discussed Lorca and we discussed Saru, you know, we are getting to know this cast and the crew a little bit more. Who's your favorite character so far, Brian?
It's still Tilly. I love her.
She's got such a potty mouth, Brian.
Yeah, really. I love how she's kind of like, she's us, you know, and I like seeing that like insecurity and yet playfulness and yet, you know, intellect. I mean, she's definitely one of the smartest people on the ship. So, anyway, I love her character. I want to see her, the friendship between, Tilly and Burnham develop. I think that they will get a lot from each other. And, yeah. And, you know, I wouldn't say that there's any characters that I really dislike. Although, you know, certain characters, you know, slant a certain way that, you know, kind of make them difficult to like in comparison to other Star Trek characters, I guess. But, what about you?
Well, this was a very redeeming episode for Stamets, in my opinion. He was hard to bear. I didn't mind his stance on things, but he was so abrasive towards everyone all the time. There wasn't a whole lot there to like. I think Saru has pulled ahead as my favorite. The way he asserted himself and actually made a pretty effective commanding officer was something, frankly, that was a surprise to me. I thought he was going to be a dismal failure because he didn't seem to have much of a backbone on the Shenzhou.
Yeah.
And, but when it came time to step up, he took a very logical approach. He asked for the qualities that good leaders had and then tried to emulate those as best he could. And also, you know, was humble enough to listen to other voices when he needed opinions on stuff. And even turned to Burnham at the end and said, look, this is something I need you to do to help me out, instead of just shutting her out of the loop, because he felt he put his personal issues aside to do what was best for the ship. So all in all, I think he showed the most surprising potential out of this episode.
Cool. I've liked Saru from the beginning. And you know, I would like to see his threat ganglia come out when there's actually a threat.
Yeah, instead of just Burnham showing up.
Well, yeah, and you know, when the Klingons are coming, you know, it didn't even come out. Oh, to Saru's point, I really liked him figuring out that you know, the ship that the raider that Lorca was piloting was in fact Lorca. I thought that was some really good deducement on his end.
Yes.
So, yeah.
He seemed to have a really good, no pun intended, command of the situation.
Yes. I will agree with what you said about Stamets too. He has been kind of abrasive and, you know, in many ways kind of a jerk. I liked, you know, seeing him laugh and seeing him be a lot more reasonable in this episode. And we haven't talked about it, but you know, the last scene, you know, with was it Dr. Culver? I think that's his name, Culver or Culber. I think it's Culver. Mm-hmm. You know, seeing, well, you know, which is, some people are making a big deal about having, you know, the first gay relationship and on Star Trek, and you know, to me, it's just the way things are. So I like that we're seeing it, because it's not a gay relationship, it's just a relationship, and I like seeing the two of them together. So I want to see that continue, seeing more of that, and I want to see more of that with other characters too. So
yeah, it'd be nice to get more backstory on these characters by seeing, I like seeing them in their off hours a little bit. It helps make them more three dimensional, instead of thinking that all these people do all day long on board the ship is just walk around and act like Starfleet.
Yeah. And to that end, I guess two little brief things, and then we should probably start to wrap it up. But Stamets, I was surprised, is the chief engineer on the ship. I guess that makes sense, given the fact that it's the spore drive, you know. So I don't know if there's like an assistant chief engineer who's like in charge of the regular warp drive or what have you. But I did not think that he was the chief engineer. So the fact that we saw that was interesting to me. And to that end, I was also surprised that Dr. Culver was not the chief medical officer, that there's some other medical officer, which is kind of surprising considering, you know, especially in this episode, we see a lot of him. We definitely don't see the CMO.
Yeah. Yeah. I caught that as well.
Yeah. All right. Do you have anything else?
Nope. I think what this episode did best was settle. I think this was the first episode that settled into a groove. Like, now we're really off and rolling. We've got enough plot devices in place, enough character development. This is the first one that managed to really feel like a Star Trek episode, but not a retread of something we've already seen, which is also something that Star Trek tends to fall into from time to time.
Definitely. Our Spot the 47 segment, all I'll say about that is it's the same as last episode.
As long as they keep showing the telescope, we've got our 47.
Yep.
Oh, and they also said, of course, the name of the episode in the episode.
Yes, they did. Very prominently. And multiple times. All right. T, to submit your feedback and connect with us. One way you can do it, and this is how Mark submitted his voicemail, was through goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback. And there you can submit text or audio. There's also a link to the page for SpeakPipe. So you can use that and send us a message. I think it's a 90-second limit, but if you want to send us a few, we'll string them together. You can also call the voicemail, which is at 304-837-2278, or our email address, which is StarTrekGSM@gmail.com. And of course, our wonderful Facebook group already, adding members, you know, almost every day at this point, facebook.com/groups/StarTrekDiscoveryPodcast. And we've gotten quite a bit of Twitter feedback. We should probably spend a little bit of time focusing on that next episode. But I saw several people send us Twitter feedback, so we'll cover it some other time. But our Twitter is at StarTrekGSM. Deadline for submitting feedback to us is Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central. Doesn't give you a lot of time, so get your feedback in right away. Another way to, well, to support us, one best way you can do it is by subscribing to us in whatever application you use. For example, if you use Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us in that. That helps us move up in the ratings, or sorry, the rankings. And while you're there, give us a rating or review like Maury did this week, who Maury gave us a 5-star Apple Podcast review. So thank you, Maury. You can find us there just by going to goldenspiralmedia.com/apple. And if you have friends that are watching Discovery and they haven't checked us out, let us know, retweet us, share our Facebook posts as well. That all that stuff helps to get the word out. Because there is already a steep competition of podcasts covering Discovery. It's like from nowhere, from zero to like, you know, over 30 podcasts in such a short amount of time. So
yeah, the popularity of the series has unfortunately already made it a very crowded podcast space.
Yeah. And we mentioned we are going to do a Patreon group very soon. Probably at this point, I would say we'll come up with it during the hiatus. And once we do, we will let you know what's going to be in there. You can support the network by going to goldenspiralmedia.com/support and choose the many ways you can support us. So we don't have any information about the next episode, except it is titled Lethe or Leith or whatever it's, whatever, L-E-T-H-E.
Actually, I did look this up on Merriam-Webster.com, and the correct pronunciation is Lethe.
Lethe.
Two long E's in there. Yes, Lethe.
Okay. All right. Well, until next time, I'm Brian.
And I'm Adam.
Peace and long life.
And live long and prosper.